It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Okay, we are back again for another week. We're joined here today with special guest Shane Burley. We're going to be talking about their new book, Why We Fight, Essays on Fascism, Resistance, and Surviving the Apocalypse. It's always great to have Shane on. We've discussed their past book, Fascism Day, What It Is and How to End It. On previous discussions, if you want to go back and see our show notes, we'll have a link to past episodes that Shane has been on. And we're also going to be talking about today what's in the news cycle, which is a lot. The Republicans are in a tuffle. We're going to talk about what this means for the ruling class in general, and also the far right, and also how this ties into a lot of the themes that are in Shane's new book. Shane, just for those that aren't aware, do you want to just introduce yourself real quick?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Shane Burley, new book. It's a collection of essays, some new, some old, and kind of revamped, called Why We Fight. I cover mostly the far right, write about anti-fascism, social movements, that kind of thing, for a bunch of spots, NBC News, Daily Beast, Al Jazeera, Truthout, a bunch of different spots, and I'll be writing a bunch of stuff in those spots coming out soon.
Awesome. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about some general questions, and then we'll move into some more discussion that are directed at Shane and the new book. So just to kind of get us started, we're going to be looking at what happened today, which is Wednesday, May 12th. Liz Cheney has been removed from head of the Republican Party. There is talk of the neocons forming sort of a third party. How that kind of will play out remains to be seen, but I know we'll discuss a little bit of it. And also, I think the big question is, what does this mean for bourgeois state politics in general? Like, what does this mean for the coming terrain?
Yeah, so, I mean, just as a little bit of background, Liz Cheney, for those of you that are not aware, is a U.S. House rep from Wyoming, is also Dick Cheney's daughter. She has been a pretty staunch conservative. I think a lot of, like, liberal types are sort of doing what liberal types do, which is like somebody comes out against Trumpism and all of a sudden they're a hero, right? They did this with James Comey and so on, and forget all of the awful stuff that they've done in the past. And so Liz Cheney is definitely one of these people who has done plenty of awful things in her career. She actually has one of the most conservative voting records in the House and so on. But she, up until today, was the sort of third ranking member of the Republican caucus in the U.S. House, and she was removed from that position today. Now, no one has been appointed yet to take that position on, although there's lots of speculation. But essentially, the reason that she was removed is relatively simple, but also incredibly illustrative. She refused to endorse the idea that the 2020 election was stolen, and not just refused to endorse it, but has been pretty vocal about that refusal. That's led people like Matt Gaetz to go to Wyoming and try and hold rallies. There's definitely going to be a primary challenge that gets launched by sort of the Trumpian wing of the party and so on. So as this has sort of developed, there's been this talk of quote moderates within the Republican Party, sort of breaking off and either forming some sort of caucus or some sort of faction or maybe even their own party. And we've been talking about this on this show for months. I mean, we start talking about something like this happening going back to last summer, and kind of tracking some of the signs that something like this was in the offing. It actually has taken a little bit longer than I thought it was going to, but we've gotten to the point now where It's not just neocons, but I would say it's like neocons and also like traditional small government Republicans, kind of Reaganites, people like that, as well as kind of like Bush era neoconservatives, have sort of come together and they've decided to issue this letter, right? And the letter essentially says, if there's not some big change, then we're going to start a third party. So what does this all mean? It actually means a lot. And to understand why it means a lot, we have to go back to thinking about something that, again, we've talked a lot on the show about, but the idea that the Republican Party is a minority but still governing party within the sort of mythology of liberal democracy. There is this idea that A, majoritarianism is okay, right, which is a highly problematic concept, but B, that the majority party or the majority position is the position which has sovereignty. What we have watched happen, partially through sort of oddities around the structure of the U.S. Senate and how the Senate sort of skews representation by population, right, but also through sort of gerrymandering of House districts. What we've watched is we've watched the Republican Party lose every single aggregate national vote. So for president or for congressional elections, lose the aggregate vote total every single election since 1996, I think, or 94, with the exception of winning a single popular vote for the presidency, which was Bush in the year 2000. Right. So when we start to look at that reality, what we're seeing is we're seeing a party which has significantly less support than the Democrats. That support is actually getting smaller all the time, and yet they're still holding on to power. And what that means is that they need literally every single vote that they can get, plus they have to suppress the turnout of everybody that's against them. And this has been, I mean, yes, people are making a lot of noise about sort of voter restrictions and things that are happening now. But as we were talking about before we started recording, this strategy goes all the way back to Newt Gingrich. So like the mid-90s when the Republican Party started existing as a kind of minority political party. One of the things that they did during that period of time is they used kind of wedge issues, what they called wedge issues, like abortion, things like that, but also conspiracy theories, like very overtly, to demonize everybody that disagreed with them and create what they called the permanent Republican voting bloc. Now that permanent Republican voting bloc is shrinking. And so we're entering into this space in which Republicans need every single vote that they can get while also suppressing turnout of everybody that disagrees with them. When a group of people like this comes forward and says, we're going to form a third party, that is actually incredibly meaningful. But it's not meaningful in the way that I think a lot of the kind of naive liberal press has been talking about it today. It's not that it's actually going to be a third party that's going to functionally challenge for power, at least anytime soon. But that's not what's relevant. What's relevant is that this party represents a faction of the Republican Party, which still very much exists, but has sort of been drowned out of the conversation. And that is a kind of traditional Ronald Reagan-esque kind of Republicanism. Which takes on many guises, including kind of Bush era neoconservatism, but still is a faction of the party which has constituency. All this new party would have to do is sort of slice off 10-15% of Republican voters, and they would functionally end the Republican Party's ability to control either House of Congress. Republicans run in these really tight races a lot, pretty consistently. And there's tons of districts that Republicans barely win by 2-3 percentage points. If this third party can peel off 10-15% of Republican voters, Republicans will lose all those districts. And that's actually the really relevant point, is that if something like this does go through, which it very much looks like it's about to, we could watch a relatively significant realignment of the way that specifically the federal government works. And the way that elections will play themselves out, kind of starting with the midterms coming up soon and sort of moving forward from there.
I'm less convinced that this will actually effectuate a break. We've seen a lot of these threats periodically, and we have seen a certain, there's a certain history of not initially third-partyism, but of kind of three candidates. There's like a Ross Perot history. There's something we could at least turn to. There's been some example of it. I think more in general, though, this is sort of the fragmenting of what the base of the Republican Party actually is. I mean, there was a growing populism out of the Tea Party and forward. And internationally, I mean, populism is sort of the political language that mobilizes people now, a kind of working-class dialect about how they experience class itself. But in the way the Republican Party overshot with having absolutely no ability to rein it in and focus it on their policy programs and to just totally give in the kind of collective illusion, that probably destabilized its ability to maintain itself. If you look at like populist parties in Europe, they are pretty out there, but they keep pretty tight commentary. Their conspiracy theories are a little bit more grounded. They're not quite as out there. They're not letting things like QAnon run rampant. And I think they lost the reins on this to a degree. We have 100 kind of Beltway Republicans who are basically acting as a smart class interest. The actual interests of the ruling class right now are some amount of stability of capital. And that's happening with Biden. If anyone has like a 401k, check it. It's doing quite well under Biden because Biden is doing kind of normal kind of Keynesian structural things that will actually stabilize it against the kind of, I don't know, quote unquote anarchic capitalist models that have come before, are coming with Trump and the suppression of interest rates and things like that. So I think it's hard for them to look at the situation and say like they're not willing to jump to the Democrats. They're not willing to stay in the Republican Party that's basically dissolving itself. So they're trying to make a stand. I think in as much as they think that that's going to send messages to donors and that message from donors will be enough to coalesce the party around their new image. I don't think it is because the energy is still with the populace and the money is not with them. So I think it actually maintains a really dramatic split, but I just don't know how it's going to play out.
So I guess the next question is, what does this mean in terms of the Trumpian right and its open coalition building with far-right street movements? Just today, Paul Gozer was praising people that entered the Capitol, calling them peaceful patriots and really downplaying it. Will this accelerate this trajectory? So like if, for instance, there is a split, will kind of the Trumpian side just even further run to embrace the far right, or is it just going to kind of stay the same?
I mean, honestly, at this point, I think one of the things that we learned today is that people like Kevin McCarthy, right, the House Minority Leader, is willing to go pretty far to legitimize Trumpism at this point. Kevin McCarthy is a person who, after the election, when the conspiracy theories were sort of emerging, stayed relatively silent, then came out against them, then came out against what happened on January 6th, and then like 3 weeks later reversed all of that. And he's doing this sort of dance where he's trying to keep the Trumpian wing happy, while at the same time maintaining some ability to be a part of the discussion still. And it's failing. It's falling apart. So what that's telling me is that really there's not really much of a check on Trumpism at all right now. There definitely doesn't seem to be a sense in which the Trumpian wing of the Republican Party thinks that what they're doing is hurting their chances of winning elections at all. They seem to be pretty bought into the rhetoric at this point, and they're kind of just rolling with it. However, I think that what we are going to see very potentially, it is not now, but as time goes on, if this trajectory doesn't reverse itself in any sort of way, I think you are going to watch a number of people who would otherwise be pushing back against this within, you know, the sort of conservative right wing sort of scene kind of drop off. To be perfectly honest, it's got to be incredibly frustrating for a person like Jeff Flake to constantly be saying, I think this is wrong, and then having nobody care. And so as those people drop away, if those people drop away, it's very likely that whatever check or balance exists on Trumpism now, which I'm not really convinced is robust in any sort of way, will in itself kind of evaporate. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. I think what we're still trying to come to terms with here in the U.S., even way after the election, right? We're almost 5 months into the Biden administration now. I still think that a lot of us are trying to understand how broad the appeal of Trumpism is and how militant that support is. So part of why this is hard to understand, I think, is that the way that we tend to gauge discourse currently is largely grounded in what's being talked about online. The thing is that, and we learned this with the alt-right, militant Trump supporters are very loud on the internet. And they're loud in a way that is outsized to their actual numbers. They are also rhetorically militant in a way that is, at least for many of them, outsized in relation to their actual militancy. And what that means is that it becomes really, really difficult to actually gauge what that support looks like. And so I think there's a lot left to be seen. On some level, I think we're going to get a bit of an idea of how this is going to perpetuate by watching to see how many Trump supporters sort of do things like show up at government buildings and threaten to shoot politicians, or like try and storm buildings again, or like a few Trump supporters have tried to jump the fence in front of the Capitol, right? You're seeing people do these kind of lone wolf things, but they're not really that intense. They're not really of this like huge giant magnitude. There's not lots of numbers of people going out and doing this kind of stuff. And so that could just be a momentary demotivation. If that changes, we're going to get a bit more of an idea of how militant at least the fringe of Trumpism is willing to be around what is essentially an electoral political movement, right? We also are going to get a gauge on numbers when we get into the midterm elections. And the reason I say that is that Trump already has said very openly he's going to primary people. I have no doubts that that's true. That has been a pretty consistent practice in the Republican Party since the Tea Party, roughly, that the fringe kind of runs primary candidates against people in their own party. If Trump is to do this, which, again, there's no reason to think he won't, we're going to get a relatively good gauge on how popular Trumpism stays over time when he's not in office and not on social media and not making headlines every single day. How popular Trumpism can stay when it comes to, you know, sort of being in a competition with, quote, normal Republicans, right? And unfortunately, I think that we're going to see that Trumpism is still wildly popular, regardless of their sort of links with far-right street movements and things like that. Far-right street movements give them a certain kind of advantage, right? The entirety of Trumpian politics is grounded in, I forgot who said this today. I was reading an opinion piece. Someone said it really well, but essentially a politics of revenge at this point. It's no longer about policy. Now it's about revenge for losing the 2020 election. It's revenge against all the, you know, communists and leftists and things like this. And, you know, Republican run states are going after things like critical race theory and these kinds of things, right? This kind of ideological battle that they're portraying as something which exists. Really benefits their narrative on that really benefits from the presence of groups like the Proud Boys, where they can sit there and say, these are the people that really understand what's happening. They're saying the same thing we are, but they're willing to go out there and actually do something about it. And you might not be willing to go do something about it, but you should really support these people that are. And it kind of creates this sort of divisiveness that widens the gaps that already exist within the American voting populace. It creates a sort of warfare mentality. And we watched that happen in the lead up to the 2020 election. I don't really see much of a reason for the kind of, quote, populist wing of the Republican Party to really do anything different in relation to that at this point.
I don't know if they structurally can do anything different. I mean, the issue with midterms have increasingly radicalizing candidates, that sort of is a built-in feature of the system. I don't think it's a bug at this point, even before it. And so I think what we're going to see is a large continuation of Trumpism. And there will be a few, I think, stalwarts that would really bring in Republican establishment. But the reality is that the Trump base acts like an emotional vanguard for their movement. And it's really the only vessel inside conservatism that has the ability to connect with working class people in any significant way. I mean, no one wants to listen to these people with their like MIT jargon and Brooks Brothers suits. They want people that are going to put expression to actual legitimate class anger on the one side, but then also the politics of resentment and resentment and privilege on the other. And so that kind of duality is what will have the energy. Now, it's still not going to give establishment money. It doesn't have like the structural advantage. It doesn't have the various think tanks and things behind it, but we're actually entering an era when that may no longer matter nearly as much. And so I think that like that what's happening now in the Republican Party is a decision about whether or not they're going to go full populism. And the Trumpist base didn't have the advantage of having the stabilizing force of the other Republicans behind them in a real way. They were starting to break away. And that's one of the things that's going to be problems. That's why they're not going to be successful like UKIP or something like that. But what will eventually happen is the Republican Party continues to go in the direction of Trumpism, either separate from those 100 Republicans in their establishment or not. We'll see something evolving like the AFD or Front National or something where it actually will be explicitly this party of like ethnic coding and civic nationalism and like resentment attacks. And I think that's where they know the energy is, because we're entering increased areas of economic and ecological collapse that will only create that disconnect. That the only way to actually speak to anyone's experience now is with that form of populism. It's in a way why Biden made some of the choices he did in office, which is essentially to do kind of old Democrat stuff, like the PRO Act, to talk to unions so much. It's not something that a lot of these other folks, because that's the message he got from the populist movement, which in a lot of ways is probably the best message he could have gotten, but that's how he has read it. And so I think that's how people going forward, there's only one way you're going to do that. You will never win another election by just talking about tax breaks and like, you know, that kind of corporate reform stuff. It just simply will not speak. We've met past that entirely. So the only way that those kind of the Republican moderates could do anything about this is if they're able to refashion a form of moderate populism. I have no idea what that would look like.
So this brings us to our next question. And on this podcast, you know, 5 months ago, we were talking about the very real realities of a possible coup. And we were joking about, you know, it ended up coming true, but it ended up formulating in a completely different way than we thought. You know, right now, as we speak, there are attacks on voting rights in multiple states. Also, there's talk of like the GOP, for instance, declaring that the election was a fraud officially, or like that segment of Republicans. And I guess the question is, as Republicans become more and more of a minority party and embrace this, as you were saying, Shane, this authoritarian, anti-democratic, you know, ethnic populist stance, what dangers do we see in terms of move they may make or change in the coming terrain in an attempt to solidify their hold onto power? And I don't know what exactly that would look like. Of course, people have put a lot of theories into play about what they might do, but I'm curious your thoughts on things that might happen or they might try to go for in the coming months.
Yeah, I think part of an answer to this question really relies on understanding how this kind of Gingrich-esque Republican Party, which is what we're living in the midst of at the moment in a lot of ways, how they view power and how they view how power functions. Democrats tend to have this really heavy focus on, you know, winning like mayor's offices and, you know, governorships and things like this, winning a lot of national offices and so on. And they tend to really focus on this sort of idea of winning office. But Republicans now understand power in a very different way, right? McConnell, for example, has spent his entire career trying to stack the court system, right? With someone like Tom DeLay, the entire battle for power in Texas was not about holding power in Texas for that moment. It was about holding power in Texas for the next 50 years. And the way that they were going to do that was by redrawing the district maps, right? And they did that. And in some ways, the Republican Party has a much more nuanced understanding of the way that power functions within the American political system and how they can leverage the mechanisms to essentially exploit that, right? So on some level, that's absolutely 1,000% going to continue, right? I think often people make a mistake by thinking of Trumpism entirely as a paradigm shift, when in reality, it is sort of operationally incredibly similar to the way that the Republican Party has, at least on a grassroots level, functioned for quite some time. The messaging is different. the way that they're willing to embrace really absurd conspiracy theories and right-wing street movements and things is different. But the general trajectory of this idea that you can sort of, you know, demonize opposition and build a permanent voting bloc and leverage that permanent voting bloc through manipulating the electoral system, that is still something that's very much in place, right? And so on some level, on the most superficial level, we're already seeing that, right? This is what the voter restriction bills are all over the U.S. It's about depressing voter turnout, and that's definitely a thing that we're going to see them not just continue to do, but potentially accelerate. The other thing that we're going to watch on a localized level, I think, is we're going to watch, and this is already happening in a lot of states, the passing of these sort of anti-protest bills, right? Now, this is not in any way the first time that specifically Republican governors have ever tried to pass bills that demonize like basic forms of political action. This is maybe the fourth go around of this sort of process in the amount of time I've been involved, which is like 20 years or so. But what they're doing now is they're doing it in a way which is intentionally confrontational. So in the past, when they would do things like this, they would say, oh, well, you know, I mean, we really need people to get permits because, you know, public services really need to know how to adapt to situations. We need to route traffic. And, you know, they'd have all these relatively normal excuses for why they wanted to do what they were essentially proposing to do. Now they're saying, we're going to pass laws and make it legal to hit protesters with cars. We're going to pass laws that make it a felony to blockade a logging road, right? I mean, just like completely absurd, totally over the top, entirely unjustifiable sort of provisions, which very, very, very directly are there to create a chill effect on political action, right? It's not even up for question that that's what's happening, right? It is very likely that we are going to see a lot more of that. And at least in some of these states, it's very likely that we're going to see increases in police repression, not on the level of just cops firing tear gas and stuff at protests, but on the level of people getting door knocks, people getting pulled in for interrogation, stuff like that. We're already seeing in Virginia, around the tree sits in Virginia, people getting comparatively very heavy sentences for things like sitting in a tree, getting one day in jail for every single day they're up in the tree. I mean, that's a sentence which is more time than most of the people who invaded the Capitol will see, just to put that in perspective. So that's definitely something that we're going to watch happen. I think on a national level, we're going to watch a number of things occur. The first has to actually do with the courts. And we're already seeing this in states like Ohio, where the state government is passing incredibly restrictive anti-abortion legislation, for example, which they know is going to get challenged in court, with the goal very, very directly of pushing that up to the Supreme Court, right? Very clearly, the Republican Party stacked the Supreme Court last year. This is part of why, right? And this is definitely McConnell's sort of strategy. I think on a sort of electoral level, the strategy that they're going to be utilizing is actually going to be something incredibly similar to what they're doing now, which is pushing this kind of authoritarian, anti-democratic stance. Now, that stance is not a stance which amongst the Republican Party is new either. To understand the roots of that stance, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, and we could draw this back to anti-communism in the 50s, for example, in the 40s. But if we want a more contemporary example, we can look at the religious right, which, take the anti-choice movement, for example, is literally an attempt to take religious morality and impose it on people's life through police force unapologetically, right? That authoritarianism is already there. It was never not there. As the Republican Party built up this permanent Republican voter bloc, they did that through demonization, but that demonization was not just, hey, look at all those people that disagree with you. They disagree with you. They're wrong. It's look at those people who disagree with you. They're heathens or they're degenerates who are going to destroy the real America. And we have to defend the real America from that. That line very specifically rose with Reagan's embrace of the religious right and then took on a sort of armed form after September 11th, where all of a sudden regular citizens are drafted into the national security apparatus through programs like See Something, Say Something. And they're coming into this situation already paranoid, are ready with this idea that every single person that doesn't look like them or think like them is a threat to their, you know, sort of continued existence, let alone the existence of the state. And so what happened in these moments is that these people sort of decided and created a culture around being informal paramilitaries to engage in counterinsurgency for the state, which is a really weird idea. But the strangeness, the paradoxes of that concept are not what's relevant. What's relevant is Republicans built a culture around that kind of armed paramilitary conservatism. People like Steve Bannon have been talking about this need to build a right-wing populist culture for a while at this point. Bannon, as far as I know, started talking about this idea in like 2013, which was about the time I started paying attention to him. He was already on this tip. But this is definitely a thing which is incredibly central to a person like that. Like, you listen to Steve Bannon's War Room, that is all he's talking about, is building conservative culture. You listen to the way he talked about Breitbart, it was about building conservative culture. And it's about doing that around creating a shared enemy and a shared language and a shared series of practices. Now, the conditions within the right wing are already there for that. That, again, has existed for the better part of 70 or 80 years at this point. But what has happened now is that, unlike in the 90s, when people like Gingrich would sort of give a wink and a nod to the militia movement and encourage them along by perpetuating their conspiracy theories, but in public would say, oh, those people are extremists, we can't deal with them, blah, blah, blah. That whole hedging, that creation of distance, is gone now entirely. And that opens up this sort of space in which, you know, as we were just talking about, the embrace of far right wing street movements is not necessarily seen as even a thing that one has to do or should do or put effort in, but it's seen as already just a given, right? There are already militias that are very attached to the conservative movement. Groups like the Proud Boys are just an extension of that. And to the degree that more and more and more of that sort of a rhetoric and culture is built on the right wing, to the degree that that accelerates, we're just going to see more and more and more of this. As they pass these kind of anti-protest bills, we are going to see a lot more repression. What is interesting about that repression is that it's not always just going to come from identifiable agents of the state, but it is going to come in the form of, you know, self-radicalized sort of right-wing activists or even just right-wing adherents who are willing to do things like shoot at people and drive cars in the protests. I think we're going to absolutely see that continue, as well as these kind of more official moves.
I think one of the questions is, at what level is this a Frankenstein's monster that can't be reined in also right? So, I mean, there's a certain amount of structural problems in the far right sphere and amongst neo-Nazis where you have a leadership caste that has certain kind of internal like agendas of their own, and then people who act seemingly spontaneously or take these acts of violence, and it literally will bring down the entire organization or structure, particularly financial infrastructure for a lot of these groups. It's something we saw really heavily after Charlottesville. The question is now that we're living in a mass radicalization event where like the very basic nature of the state is being called into question by conspiracy theories, basic humanity is sort of being called into question with QAnon and human trafficking, conspiracy theories, things like that. So the level of instability is just so high that the idea that these people won't engage in these seemingly impulsive acts of violence, I think, is a delusion that that's really implicit in their voter strategy, which is to build up this sort of sense of a vigilante, because that vigilante takes action. The action they want them to take is to basically reify their power, vote, you know, be involved in party functionaries, that kind of thing, whatever maintains kind of right-wing power. But what actually it does is it creates this kind of internal flux where people are constantly chasing the ability to affect change, to involve themselves in what seems like a radicalizing spate of evil that's affecting people's lives and requires such a level of intervention that normal structures couldn't apply. So in a way, the question is with Trumpism is whether or not it created such a strong impulse in people to fight back, to fight the state and, satanic pedophiles, that kind of thing, that it's actually going to create more instability than they can actually hone in. And that will actually destroy its ability to be a piece of a state apparatus. I mean, that's one of the things is that they're using revolutionary language for acts that are very the opposite of a revolution, basically voting, being party functionaries. These sorts of things have to have that stability to them, but they're basically putting those things at odds with one another. And yeah, I think this, we talked about this a little bit before we hopped on the air, but this kind of comes back to the questions from Carl Schmitt about where the state of exception kind of is. And there's a sort of a rebellion that's happening inside the Republican Party and a lot of populism in general against the notion of soft power, that you have to use influence, maybe even coercion, but really gently, that you influence culture down the line, that you are a part of negotiations, things like that, that leads to power through kind of whipping up your base. Instead, it's sort of like the fetishization of hard power, of power that's taken by force. And for all the kind of democratic language that's used at the heart of populism, it's really a revolt against the process of democratically gaining soft power. It's really about the kind of unwillingness to go along with the status quo, because the status quo got us where we are. We know that the rhetoric of both the right and the left in terms of the party don't actually deliver anything for working people. And so the idea that we're going to go along with the soft power process, the democratic process of parties and voting and negotiations and ballot measures, feels like this fraud that they're being forced into. And so hard power feels like the kind of answer there, which is, again, at odds with their basic notion. So it's creating this internal kind of fire that I don't know how they're going to kind of control. I think on the repression thing, I think that the Democrats will outflank the right on this. I think that this is, you see this in Democratic cities all over the place. You can see it in kind of the Kamala Harris model. I think that when Biden comes in and wants to appeal to, because what he's trying to do is trying to take Trump's white men away from him, which he will do very ineffectively. But what he'll want to do is basically be anti-woke, Keynesian leftism. So it'll be like, you know, we're not going to put up with all that Antifa shit. We're going to designate ourselves separate from that kind of, you know, anarchist jurisdiction stuff, and instead try and make a point that they are going to be the new kind of party of the people that doesn't put up with Gen X or Gen Z nonsense. And so I think they're actually we're going to see repression coming in Democratic cities that really want to take those things back, that are tired of our shit or whatever. And I think that's going to happen at the top level too. So I think that the law and order stuff is going to come on all sides. Obviously, the car defense bills that basically legalize murdering protesters are going to have a really dramatic effect. And like we said, it's going to be a chilling effect most specifically. But I actually wouldn't be surprised if these are like Democrat DAs that start using a lot of those bills, because they're trying to kind of make a stand and show they're not part of some kind of like Antifa Democrat axis.
Great one. just one of the lies on which we're nurtured. Patriotism, blind faith in the state. Relate to xenophobia and race hate. The innocents died when the war flags flew. A scared human being's no different from you. In the God of Mercy's name, they are to be cleansed. The commies, the subverts, the gypsies and you.
We're going to move on now to some questions directed specifically at Shane about the book. And a lot of this is going to be based around what's been going on in Portland. And, you know, both the right and people like Ted Wheeler have attempted to brand protesters as Antifa into this, you know, huge block or Black Lives Matter. And often this comes with, you know, placing people in racial categories, often to the anger of local activists, of course. And I'm just curious, you know, how successful has this been, either from people like on the right trying to, you know, brand people in a certain way, or people like Ted Wheeler trying to do it in a different one?
I mean, it certainly happened. I don't know. It'd be hard to say if, like, Ted Wheeler and the people's intentional kind of disruption efforts did it, or if there's implicit problems in a lot of movement spaces that did it already. But yeah, I mean, there is, I think what happens in these kind of mass mobilizations like happened in 2020 is that people with not identical politics create a sort of like emotional coalition in this kind of shared struggle. But over time, those differences really do come out. And there's a sort of, as people radicalize in those spaces, those differences become really hardened. And I think that happened to a degree in Portland and other places. You know, like there is, was a really growth of like a young anarchist Black bloc presence that then had odds with kind of maybe more establishment-minded organizations that were really on defund the police messages and had some kind of like, not necessarily policy programs, but had some kind of reformist steps. And those things came at odds. And they do come at odds, I think, historically. And this is a common process. This was not the first place I saw that. And so I think that the labeling of like kind of Antifa as white anarchists, which just erases all folks of color in the community, it did help, I think, to sow that division, the divisions that were already there, by creating a really identifiable narrative that people could kind of throw at one another. So it does have a kind of effect of attacking social movements from within by trying to use a kind of misplaced identity politics language to actually undermine solidarity.
I don't know if you talk about this in the book, but how did the far right respond to the rebellion in Portland over the past year, either in terms of outright violence, misinformation, counter-mobilization, and were they successful in doing so or not so much? It seemed like it was a slow boil in Portland. Like originally they kind of left things alone, and then towards the end of the year, then they started to try to introduce themselves physically.
I mean, it was generally really cowardly, as it often is. There was a lot of attacks on protesters that happened when they were caught by themselves or someone came, you know, there's a number of things like pipe bomb attacks that happened, you know, someone would, you know, open fire out of their car, things like that. So there was a lot of those sorts of instances. The best example, I think, of how they responded to the uprising, and one of the problems, I think this gets back to what we were talking about earlier, is their inability to effectuate a real ideological response because they're so kind of baked into these delusions was how they dealt with the forest fires. So, you know, we have the pandemic that begins, right, in about, you know, February, March-ish. And that takes us right into then the beginning of the uprising that goes to the summer. And we're talking about well over 100 days of consistent protests every day that are big or being busted by the cops every single day. And then at the end of the summer, we get the massive forest fire. So it was about, I think the number is about 12% of Oregon was on fire. It was really dramatic. You know, the fires were within, I think, 6 miles of my house. And I live in the city. I don't live like on the edges. So it was very encroaching. And a lot of people are being evacuated really quickly. And a lot of people, because there was a lot of coming out of the pandemic, there was a lot of mutual aid work that was created. That mutual aid work created the infrastructure for the protests, and then it diverted directly to the forest fires. And actually, that was the first thing that broke the string of days in a row of protesting was the forest fires. It was, you know, it totally blotted out the sun, and you probably saw a lot of those photos. It was unbreathable outside. And so what happened, but how the right responded to this was with a frantic delusion that Antifa was setting the forest fires. Now, obviously, there's no evidence of this. There wasn't even a really consistent rumor about it that you could point to and say, oh, yeah, there's a coherent conspiracy theory, and here's where, like, the trail leads. Instead, it was just this mass kind of delusion that took place in rural counties outside of the city that created barriers to people getting in and out. And so they started creating these sort of like civilian checkpoints that would try and stop people and interrogate them about whether or not they were Antifa. And you saw a lot of these like looters will be shot because the idea was that Antifa was coming in, starting the forest fires, and then looting, you know, real Americans' homes. What it did was that was attacked their neighbors. I mean, what happened was their response to Antifa was to start accusing their neighbors of being Antifa and attacking them and putting them in harm's way and stopping like aid workers from coming in and saving lives and stuff. So I think in a lot of ways that was their biggest response. There was a couple really big flashpoints of violence where Proud Boys and other folks, mostly unaffiliated folks, though, came out and did these sort of Black the Blue rallies. They weren't as big as the demasking rallies, which usually happened somewhere separate. They didn't actually cross paths with the abolitionist protesters. But like, for example, in August, there was a one day where they kind of came out, and then I mean, not ironic. It's just kind of the facts of how this plays out. It was the one day that the police decided not to intervene on any of the anti-police protesters, and instead they let the far right have their have full recourse to do whatever they wanted, which was to pull guns on people, hit them with baseball bats, break bones, people were sent to the hospital, shoot people with pepper spray, that kind of thing. That was only when they were able to get to such a capacity that they actually could rival the numbers of the anti-racist protesters, and they did it basically with the entire complicity of the police. But if it was ever more of like a fair kind of comparison, they didn't come out. They sometimes would come out with body cams and masks and try and blend in so they could try and catch people committing crimes or that kind of thing, but generally they stayed away. Once there was real confrontations and there was violence between both sides, they stayed really far away. So after there was like the shooting of the Patriot Prayer member, they didn't come around for quite a long time. When there was armed folks at a number of protests hitting more into the fall, there was armed contingents. I think some were John Brown Gun Club, and there was other folks. They stayed really far away from that, particularly at that eviction blockade at the place called the Red House that was up in North Portland that was going on for a number of days. That had a really massive blockade, hundreds of people, you know, large food coordinating systems. They had armed guards there the entire time, and the far right stayed really far away from that generally. So I think any time that people actually kind of put up a fight in a way, they stayed away. But any time it became really clear that it was not going to be one-sided violence, then they were gone.
I want to go back to the issue of like the pipe bombs and, you know, the one-off shootings and stuff like that. And we've covered that pretty extensively on This Week in Fascism, if you want to go back. It seemed like the news and also the local government made a real decision that they were going to kind of, it seems, downplay it in a certain way. You know, I mean, of course, like right now, Ted Wheeler's trying to make a big deal about property destruction of, you know, corporate windows and stuff like that. But I mean, it seemed like there was a decisive decision to not play up the fact that far right wing people were literally throwing, you know, improvised explosive devices and shooting people on the left at these demonstrations. I mean, is that?
I think so. I think there was an effort to suggest that anything that took place there was the responsibility of the protesters. That, in a way, this is part of the effort to depoliticize the protests and to portray them as criminal activities, or to portray conflicts as lacking in political motivation or content. Therefore, you can claim it's kind of all part of this like miasma of violence and, you know, degeneracy, or just, you know, the destruction of a city, that kind of thing. And so when these attacks would happen, people would sort of employ this narrative that, like, we don't know if it was even from the other side. We don't know it was from the far right. Maybe it was from your side. Maybe it was an accident. There's all kinds of these narratives that somehow the protesters were actually involved in the own violence that they were receiving. And so that happened, I think, repeatedly over the course of this. The other thing was, the bottom line was, the police were not going to treat it the same way that they were treating the left. It was very, very blatant. So, like, for example, we have this Back the Blue rally. A lot of people got hurt. For example, like Robert Heavens got his hand broken on camera during that. People were dragged away. It was very, very violent. People were openly pulling guns, that kind of thing.
This is the demonstration that ended with basically Portland basically kicking those people out.
Exactly, yeah, they were eventually surrounded and pushed out of the city. Only then did the police decide to come in. And the police,
right, and then they came in.
They came in and attacked the left. I mean, they stayed two blocks away during the entire thing. You could hear them on the megaphone saying things like, police yourselves, everyone deserves a right to an opinion. And then that night, at an entirely not a violent demonstration, they beat the ever-living shit out of people with batons. So it was very blatant what was going to happen. So obviously, like, it ended up creating a situation where no one could actually see the violence that was happening to protesters in a way, even though statistically, not just in Portland, but all across the country. And I did, like, an article with Alexander Reed Ross about this where we went through the data, and you could see very clearly that the epidemic of violence that was happening during the protests was happening against the protesters, either from the police or from far-right white vigilantes. So that ended up being totally erased by this entire narrative about the chaos of the protests, as if the broken windows were somehow complicit in the violence being received.
One other thing before we kind of continue on, I'm curious, you know, the incident with Jay Daniels and Michael Reinl, what do you feel is kind of the legacy of that or the reverberation of that? I know that there was a lot of anger, of course, around that shooting, not even talking about the shooting itself, but when literally like lots of Trump supporters and Proud Boys flooded into Portland, part of a caravan. There's actually a really interesting blog post that was written on like a Bike for Portland website. It was for like cyclists and stuff, where they kind of wrote like an open letter to Ted Wheeler, but just saying like, how are you allowing this? Like, you've spent months flooding the streets with tear gas, beating people, you know, bringing in the, you know, all these forces to crush these Black Lives Matter demonstrations. And here are these Trump supporters that are literally trying to run people over and then beating them with bats and shooting them with projectiles from their vehicles. Of course this ends with, the shooting that takes place. And then several days later, Michael Reinl is shot and killed, by state forces. I'm just curious, you know, how did that impact things in Portland?
Well, I think on the one side, it's that the far right organization saw it as an act of aggression against them, and it was threatening, and like there was a certain kind of gap. I think that there was this perception that they could sort of bully protesters or frighten them, and that would be one-sided, and it turned out not to be. I think at the same time, though, it added the shooting from Reinhold did increase police repression on people. It did increase the kind of rhetoric about Antifa violence, this like hyperbolic nonsense about like Antifa's responsibility and things. I think it also made very clear that if when someone was going to shoot back against being attacked by the protesters, that they were not going to get state sanctions on something like this. You know, they were not going to be like rewarded for standing their ground and defending themselves. Obviously, that's something people generally knew, but I think this was a really clear kind of story about it. I think also because people didn't know him really. I never met him. I don't think he was a part of any organizations. I think it ended up being also a story about the kind of complexity of a mass movement where new people are involved and maybe make rash decisions or don't make calculated decisions or aren't part of organizing spaces and thinking about it that way. And that raised the stakes on what people's actual experience of the street protests are. That all that being said, I don't think it had quite the impact that I assumed it would have had. I think that because things were so elevated during that period and there were so many attacks from vigilantes, that even though they were trying to erase that story, and even though it was being kind of sublimated to the story of like Antifa chaos or whatever, it sort of, I think, made sense to people why it happened and didn't end up kind of sticking with the uniqueness of it being Antifa, quote unquote, because it really had nothing to do with an anti-fascist organization. So I think it ended up being like part of the kind of cumulative violence of what the vigilantes were bringing in.
It also happened when they were trying to push this whole, like, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse is a hero. So it was, you know, an incident where this guy was being, you know, according to the videos, was being stalked by these two, you know, far right, you know, Patriot Prayer members. And then, you know, there's an altercation and he defends himself, and yet he's a bad Antifa, you know, terrorist, but yet Kyle Rittenhouse is some, you know, hero because he drove across state lines with, you know, high powered weapons, to police some other neighborhood. But yet this guy from, you know, standing up for his hometown is a bad person. Didn't make much sense to me.
It was sort of like also when they wanted to pick and choose when people would be politicized. So you had someone like Michael Reinhold who clearly was like new to political things that, you know, you can kind of tell from like the posts that were used very heavily. You know, it's not someone who has a big kind of radical political background, that kind of thing. Yet everything about what happened was placed into this kind of hyper-politicized context. This is Antifa tactics. It's praxis of some form. It's directly derivative of what other Antifa organizations say. See, they kind of led him into it. Versus Kyle Rittenhouse, who engages in impulsive violence, and all of a sudden, you know, this is, you know, calculated to defend people. It's, you know, it's just him, you know, standing up for his community, that kind of thing. So I think that the actual legacy of this is that it sort of took the mirage off that people can make, that this could be safe, that what's happening in these conflicts could work out. You know, like several years ago, these were, you know, I think actually I hopped on with you right after this happened when, Joy Gibson and the Proud Boys led a march directly into an anti-fascist block, and it was just unremitting violence. And there's like these videos of it. And, you know, while people were being drug out and there was concussions and head trauma, there was a lot of discussion. It's like, well, there's just people that got in a fight. You know, people get in fights. At least it didn't escalate. Well, in the case of the Reinhold shooting, that, for example, was one of the incidents where people were like, this actually does have a cost in a way for everyone involved. And so I think the realness of the what the vigilantes are bringing into the community became really visible with that.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at IGD_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show. Well, I want to turn now to something more recent. Portland just saw a very disturbing incident where around 30 Proud Boys that were armed threatened people in a neighborhood while they were providing security at a GOP event. This was at a local church that was not made aware of the nature of the event, but it was hosted by the local Republicans. In some ways, they were... It seems in some ways they've kind of given up on, quote, winning the hearts and minds of a lot of people, and they seem to be very determined also to spread misinformation. You know, we brought up the whole thing about the wildfires and stuff like that. I'm just kind of curious to know what kind of tendencies you're seeing among, like, the street forces on the right up there. I mean, is that the reality, or are they still trying to get people to their side? And I'm also just curious about this connection between, you know, groups like the Proud Boys and, you know, established political parties like the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, they're not as separate as I think people would like to believe. In Oregon, there's a certain, and the same is true in Washington and kind of other rural areas of Pacific states where there is a far-right contingent that touches the Republican Party. Here, there's these movements called, like, Timber Unity, which are trying to unite people in extractive industries in rural areas around kind of a far-right or a populist right message. And they support, for example, like, the GOP politicians, like, walking out of the state capitol and hiding in Idaho so they don't have to vote on, like, really mild environmental legislation. The Proud Boys are very hyper-present in those spaces. And they'll do, like, and this is not just true in Oregon, like, Proud Boys provide GOP security all over the place. But what it does is it shows, I think, a break of what we were talking about earlier, of their inability to keep their guys in line. One of the realities about the Proud Boys is that they really still are sort of a wild card. They aren't really capable of winning hearts and minds unless they have a kind of intermediary to do it. But when they're left to their own devices, they really are sort of on edge all the time. And in Oregon, where, you know, if you're not a friend of the Proud Boy, you're likely going to be one of their enemies, they respond really impulsively. And I think, for example, if we're talking about one of the legacies of the Reinhold shooting, they have escalated their responses to things. They react much stronger, they much more impulsively, and they're much more heavily armed after that event and going forward. So I think, like, what happened at the security for the GOP event makes total sense for their inability to keep it together. But that's the direction of the Oregon GOP and a lot of state level GOPs that are following a national trend. But what they're doing is they know that their base are people like the Proud Boys, and they have to find a way to connect with those people. So I think that what's going to end up happening is as the GOP in Oregon is sort of pushed, they're going to have that primary model of going increasingly more radical, but then being unable to rein it in. So I think it's creating an unworkable situation for them, but it's also created a lack of a chain for the Proud Boys to maintain their structural integrity. I think it's hard for them to continue being an organization. We saw a real rise of the Proud Boys in the absence of the formal alt-right when they started to decline. Identity Europa started to take a hit. But now the Proud Boys are just present in so many criminal cases. Their leadership is collaborating with the FBI. I think that at this point, they're starting to implode. So I think hopefully that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah, I mean, in this incident that we're talking about, they were literally telling Portland residents, they said if Antifa shows up, I mean, whatever that means, then we'll know who called them. So basically threatening them.
Yeah.
It's just very clear that that's not going to win very many friends.
They really are like the modern incarnation of neo-Nazi skinheads in a lot of ways, where they talk about being there as a representative of the community, except they turn on the community immediately and just basically enact violence on anyone that shows any kind of objection to their presence.
Well, I'm just kind of curious, you know, going into the future, where do you see the relationship between already kind of touched on this, the relationship between the GOP and formations like the Groypers and the Proud Boys continuing, either on a local level or
national
level?
There's always a piece of the GOP that collaborates with the far right in a much more open kind of way. You know, like paleocons in the 80s, there's a lot of these kind of populist folks in the 90s, Buchanan and others. And I think that that's happening now. The alt-light, what we called the alt-light for a long time, was that sort of middle ground between the actual GOP and the alt-right. And so they sort of were that internet savvy group of kind of hucksters that used a lot of civic nationalist rhetoric as a dog whistle. And there's been sort of a, though it's a little bit more tenuous than it was, there's still been a kind of pathway there through, like, particularly the Groypers, that they had a little bit for a while, some kind of attempts at collaboration with TPUSA, but more like the America First stuff and the, like, AMPAC conference and things like that. So I think there's a little bit of it. That being said, it's not, people are much more savvy to white nationalism than they were several years ago. And it's a lot harder for these organizations to function because of anti-fascist campaigns. So I do think that there has been a real break in their ability to do that connection. That being said, all it requires is clever rebranding and reorganization. And I think as the GOP continues to kind of push down the road of national populism as its defining feature, it's going to be more and more of these instances, probably more at a local level than a national level, but I wouldn't be surprised at the national scale either.
You know, so much of the counter info war that's been waged online since the rebellion kicked off, you know, has happened, of course, you know, outside of the public sphere, and it's happened on the internet. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, your thoughts once the pandemic, quote, ends, if that even happens, and, you know, groups and organizations and people start to hold, you know, public events inside spaces or film discussions or just open meetings face to face. What do you think movements need to do in terms of having a dialogue with the general public to push back against either the misinformation from the far right or even just like neoliberal talking points against social movements?
I think, you know, I talk about this in the book a lot, is that what I think that one of the big stories about 2020 is the growth of mutual aid, not just as some kind of like ideological project, but as a real lived solution to the crisis. So I think that's the story people are going to need to stick with, that these are about community building and that they have real consequences and effects. So I think that's really important to be at the front and center. Because what they want to do is capture the story of radicalism and tell it in a depoliticized way with like the language of criminality. And we have to come back with the realities of it, which was about 2020. And obviously all the years during the Trump presidency were about resiliency despite an incredible amount of repression. And so that's, I think, a story we want to capture and make sure is told. I think also I think it's important to not let these moments where things like police abolition start to make sense get lost as we're moving on. We need to really continue the conversation about how it wasn't, you know, a police officer, it wasn't these police, it wasn't Trump's police, it wasn't federal police, it was policing itself, and that needs to continue to be a part of that conversation. And so I think making sure that you can connect with people on those issues, I think is going to be really critical. I think we haven't yet to see the full effects of what the economic crisis was resulting from the pandemic. And so it's going to require continued union organizing, working with tenants unions, being prepared to block evictions, being prepared to block deportations that are still coming down. And so I think having the ability to offer something publicly and say, like, we're here to actually stand with you in these times. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. These are the projects that we want to see going out. Having that kind of forward thinking vision and talking to people about that, I think is really important, because it's important that that coming out of such a profound crisis, people know that there's an absence of solutions, and we have to actually offer them very clearly to be able to draw a line between what our ideas are and what the practical application is. And I think when people have seen that bit of absence, that little moment of crisis, that actually makes it much clearer what needs to be done.
So last big question from us, you know, what would you say are some of the key lessons that you would take away from Portland over the past year that's impressed on you, either in terms of what the social movements actually were able to accomplish or hard limits that they showed themselves coming up against?
Well, I think the big one is that infrastructure is important. You know, there was mutual aid projects all over the place, but there was reasonably sophisticated coordination between them. And also people sort of taking turf, like some groups were just there to get people rides. Some people are just there to be available for a ride home when someone got bailed out. So a lot of people were there for food or medical supplies, things like that. That kind of thing is necessary for social reproduction. I think social movements require it. And in an increased area when the state and social systems and social service agencies and NGOs are unable to meet people's basic needs, people have to meet those needs before they're able, I think, to build vibrant community or forms of resistance. So we have to figure out how to meet those needs. And to do it in a way that doesn't depoliticize it and keeps it within the movement context is important. I think, you know, the hard limits in a lot of ways were ideological and also the differences between communities. You know, there was a lot of infighting that happened in those spaces. And it'd be really easy for me to give you a prescription about that. I think the reality is that people, there needs to be a lot more, sticking to principles of agreement and in finding enough ability to collaborate on broad issues that we can maintain those alliances for long periods of time. I think also there was a certain kind of focus on particular forms of action, particular types of protests, even when they were draining everyone's energy and resources. I think, you know, hindsight's 2020 and looking back about that. But I think what it did show as possible was that you could have a consistent movement that maintained a militant presence, but actually grew and was able to communicate to new people halfway or later into its existence, not just in the beginning. It wasn't just like Occupy, where the first 2 months made a lot of sense to people and people got tired of it. It actually increased over time. And so I think thinking about some of those uprisings as not just fighting against the police, but as an occupation of itself, we created space, the community created an alternative space. There was different rules in that space. There was kind of a vision of a new type of social relationship. Talking about it in that way, I think changes how we saw that period, because it then becomes a really strong window into what's possible and starts to open up the fact that the conditions that created are only going to continue. And the relationships that were formed there and the tools that people use and the ideas that came out of it, those are only kind of more flourishing. So I think that this is even more possible in the next few years. You know, so like the tagline of my book is about the apocalypse, and all the chapters do deal with the end of the world and to some degree, or at least the feeling of doom. But it's actually really optimistic. I am incredibly optimistic. I just lived through an incredible crisis of 2020, but I also lived through people's unbelievable innovation and willingness to care for each other and to try new things and to see communities radicalized at a scale I just didn't think was possible before. So I think we have every reason to be excited about what comes next, because we're the ones doing it.
I think the biggest question, and this is the thing that I always come back to, is how do you see the next phase of this playing itself out, right? So, I mean, you're in Portland. Portland has very specific conditions, but on a more general level, we're about to hit the summertime again. We're very clearly seeing that when police continue to murder people, it generates a response that's not entirely dissimilar from what happened last summer, just not on the same scale. But how are you seeing the next phases of this sort of play themselves out in both the immediate and kind of mid to long term?
I mean, I think that it depends on how, whether or not people are able to collapse their movements back into some kind of collaboration. You know, it's like in Portland's a good example where there's certain like militant anarchist contingents that are now separate from a lot of the like kind of, I guess, more broad left coalitions for a lot of reasons. That's not like just on them or something, you know, like that there's been a lot of kind of difficulties of collaboration. So like, you know, when, for example, the Chauvin trial was wrapping up and there was a police shooting here in Portland of an unarmed man, there was two protests that were separate, you know, one that was the kind of militant direct action protest that went through the city, through the downtown, and then one that kind of went across the bridge over to the east side. And so the idea of that, I think, shows a really present dynamic. And I would like to see some way for that, those that collapse themselves together to create some kind of confederal way of working together. That, I think, will dictate how successful those things are going forward. But I think what's happening now is that we're seeing accelerating crises that are not all the same, but all have a kind of underlying continual logic to them. So whether it's on its ecological, or if it's about police murders, or it's about white supremacist violence, or if it's about the economic crisis of housing and workplaces, things like that, it's happening at an accelerated rate. And we're finding the ability to build coalitions very quickly out of both existing organizations and semi-spontaneously. So I actually think that as the summer months continue, the existing fractures will continue enough to bring people out. And the question is whether or not we're able to seize that moment effectively. And I don't have an answer to that. I actually think that there's a lot unwritten here. And I don't think that material conditions will dictate it. I think that there's a lot of agency that we have in our ability to kind of take that on. But I think that the question is, it's not going to be whether or not people take the right tactics or whether or not they're out, but whether or not we're able to create permanent space here, and whether or not this kind of sense of rebellion is one that doesn't just come with one uprising and fade and we hope for the next one, but that it remains a constant step in people's lives, that approach to organizing, that approach to their community, of a kind of permanent revolution, that has to be the thing that predominates. Because otherwise, we're just going to see the constant revival of start and stop and burgeoning and failed social movements and recuperation by the state and social systems and capital. So there has to be a sense that this kind of rebellion against the kind of interlocking structures of oppression, it has to be permanent. And I think we're seeing the windows of that now. And I think there's more reason to believe that's possible now than there was 10 years or 50 years or 100 years ago. And so that makes me optimistic.
Well, just to sign us off, just two short, really quick questions. The first is, you kind of alluded to this already, but as we go into the summer, I'm curious, what do you see the far right doing?
Well, so with the far right, I think that we're seeing a stage of what generally brings seemingly impulsive acts of violence, basically presenting a situation in which their failure would bring crisis and then they fail. So the idea that a Biden presidency ushers in a new era of, you know, adrenochrome farms or something, that creates an internal crisis. I was talking with a colleague, a friend, Sarah Hightower, who kind of investigates QAnon, and she was talking about how people are sort of traumatizing themselves with their own, like, mythology, that they're telling stories about child sacrifice that are so profoundly upsetting that it's literally changing their cognition. And so I think that we are entering a period in which seemingly impulsive acts of violence take place on the one hand, under the guises of being freedom fighters or something, and then also attacks on protesters anytime there's BLM protests, which there will be during the summer, or even like Biden events and Democrat events, I think will end up being targeted. So I think those kind of acts of violence will continue. In the Pacific Northwest, I think it's going to be built a lot around what the local GOP does during the summer months. And then I think the increased consolidation around continued anti-mask protests, which has continued over here, actually nationally, but here especially, to have a lot of energy behind it. And so I think they're going to continue with that. They'll refocus on the vaccine, away from the masks and towards the vaccine, but they'll maintain that through a line as a way of getting these kind of large events. Oh, all along conspiracy lines, is that being the central narrative, kind of attacking ideology as the central binding factor, instead of having consensus disreality as being the binding factor.
But you don't see them holding like free speech rallies like a la 2017 or something like that?
I don't think that free speech would be the branding of it. I think that it will more like taking a stand rallies against political corruption and like the, you know, a big pharma. I think at this point, their belief that speech solves anything is wrong. In fact, they're further radicalizing themselves. Now they think that it's not just an attack on free speech, it's an attack on democracy itself. So we're going to have lots of rallies declaring the government totally illegitimate, or captured by, you know, occupational force, that kind of thing, which I think has the potential of being even more violent. But it also has the kind of dual effect of sort of breaking their tacit alliance with a lot of the police. And it's a lot of that kind of anti-federal government rhetoric that has historically broken alliances between the far right and police forces, like happened in the 80s. So it can be difficult to kind of predict exactly how that'll play out.
You know, one question we've been asking a lot of people that a lot of people have been talking about is this idea of how do we consolidate the gains that have been made?
I mean, there's a couple of answers here. On the one hand, organizations themselves, former organizations, have a role in that, particularly when it comes to like labor unions and things like that, that can do that. At the same time, though, we're in an era where we're not, I think that what you dictate, what kind of gains, what we dictate as gains shouldn't be just things like concessions from the state. Instead, it should be gains in our ability to kind of generate and exercise power as a community. And so what I would like to see as sort of the accumulation of that, as taking skills, experience, and networks and collaboration to create permanent working relationships that are able to continue things. I want to see the consolidate things in terms of mutual aid networks as like kind of a holding pattern for community organizations that have the ability to kind of kick into action when things are taking place. I think doubling into things like tenant unions and labor unions that have the ability to be there all the time is really important, and have the ability to measure their gains not in terms of state concessions, but instead of things that are gained outside of the state entirely. I think that's going to be really important. I think it's important to hold this energy away from electoral politics as much as possible, because that will be so, it will demolish it so quickly. And I think that's already starting to happen, as like Biden makes kind of moves to attract kind of pieces of like left labor, for example. So I think as much as possible, people can create lasting either organizations or workable networks that can exist in between things. That will be the measure of how to consolidate it. Because the gains that we, you know, if for example, if we're measuring by like, you know, state concessions or something, in periods of austerity, they'll take those things right back. Instead, I think the kind of gains that we should be measuring is how powerful are we to make decisions as a community, protect each other, support each other, and create a kind of lasting, thriving relationships. That is really what I think will measure whether or not we are successful in it.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.